Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Danielle Moody.
And I'm Mujahat Ali.
And Waj, well, you know, it's another week in America where we text each other nonstop and say, should we pack now or not? What of the mountain of shit that we've been ingesting all week do you want to dig into?
Okay, let's spin the wheel. The wheel here, it goes round and round. And oh yeah, the guy who's nearly tied with President Biden to be the next president, Donald Trump, is on trial, farting his way to keep himself awake while Stormy Daniels, his former mistress, is testifying in lurid detail to their sexual affair, after which he allegedly paid her in hush money during the 2016 campaign to silence her, which is, by the way, illegal. He might go to jail for it, but of course it's Donald Trump, so he'll fail up. But we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about college protesters who are overwhelmingly peaceful, but apparently Joe Biden yesterday does a speech on anti-Semitism to mark the day in the Holocaust memory, and he says that Hamas is motivated by, quote, ancient desires to eliminate Jews, which is interesting because Hamas was created in 1987, so I don't know about these ancient desires. And while that's happening, Chip Roy, a Republican, brings back the anti-Sharia panic from 2014 and decides to now label all Muslims as potential threats. That was awesome. No one talks about it. And oh yeah, as this is happening, Hamas agreed to a ceasefire deal, which Antony Blinken said was extraordinarily generous last week. But Netanyahu says, nope, no ceasefire. We didn't agree to it. And they decide to invade Rafah. If you've seen the videos and images, it's a disaster. And the United States, surprise, surprise, has punted this report on Israel allegedly violating international law and humanitarian rights. I wonder why. Maybe because, translation, they found out that Israel violated international law and humanitarian rights. And as this is happening, we're sitting here wondering why Democrats aren't taking this seriously. Why Joe Biden, who has proven to be flexible and nimble when it comes to amending his previous record, for example, the crime bill, for example, everything to do with black people, for example, his support for the disastrous war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan. On this issue, Daniel, on the issue of Israel and Palestine and Gaza, why, oh, why is he not, in my opinion, you might disagree with me, reading the tea leaves? Why is the Democratic establishment not witnessing what's happening? And why are they downplaying, not just young voters, Danielle, but increasingly, if you look at all the polls, voters who are like, why the hell are we supporting Netanyahu? And by the way, folks, these protests now have exploded in Israel. So good luck calling Jews protesting Netanyahu anti-Semitic. And by the way, I have to mention this, for the first time ever, we held up a small amount of arms to mm-hmm. Israel. So
they're
we did
on
that.
Pause.
Yeah, yeah. So a small pause. So, you know, you and I are sitting here with all that's happening. A, we're shocked that the fact that Donald Trump might have a chance to win with multiple cases. I think 88 criminal indictments for criminal cases. And the fact that Biden is going out of his way to sledgehammer young people especially as this election is very close in the swing states. Did I do a good summary in the last 2 minutes?
I mean, you left out all the horrible things that are happening with abortion, but we'll just that to another day. But you know, where I find myself troubled, and everyone who I think listens to me knows that I vacillate between having hope for the future of our democracy and also looking at my passport lovingly and wondering, where can I live? Because when I listened to part of Biden's speech yesterday, I was just so taken aback. Because the question that I posed on social media was, as we're remembering this very important time in world history, Holocaust Remembrance Day.
A genocide.
When we say never again, which is what folks say around this day and that horrific time in the world's history, never again, never again. This is why it's so important to remember. Who exactly are we talking about? Because it has become increasingly clear that when we say never again, we're only talking about a particular group of people. The reason why, right, we have all of these college protests that have now exploded, not just in our universities in the United States, but in universities around the world, as well as continue to explode on the streets of Tel Aviv, is because what people are seeing with their own eyes, not whitewashed through mainstream media, on applications like TikTok, is a genocide, right? When you're looking at people who have no arms, no means whatsoever to flee, they're being ushered. If you think about it like a cattle rancher who has a small amount of land, he's saying, go north to the cattle, go south, but you're on this patch of earth and that's it. Like, what are the options? There are none. When you bomb every hospital, when you bomb every school, right? When you blockade, when the UN and other outlets are saying that 2 million people are near starvation, when do you decide that there's a humanitarian crisis? Is it in 10 years when then you say, oh, we have Palestinian Remembrance Day because we refuse to take any fucking action in real time, but let us reflect on it in hindsight? But I realized something, Waj. This is what I've realized over the last several months of this heinous, heinous war, is that the numbers that you and I and everyone else look at, and we are just appalled and disgusted, 37,000 people dead, 15,000 children. These numbers, when you look at the wars that America has spearheaded in the world and the amount of death that we have caused, this doesn't even scratch the surface. You're looking at, you know, hundreds of thousands in Iraq, hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan, a million, right? We dropped the bomb in Nagasaki. Vietnam, hundreds of thousands of deaths, right? I believe that Biden looks at this through the framework of American history and aggression and is just like, well, this is the price of war. This is the price of, you know, Israel having the ability to defend itself, because America has defended itself. And when we do, we drop bombs that execute hundreds of thousands in a clip and poison generations. So I think that he honestly thinks, people will forget about it.
You know, I think for him, it's more ideological. Just listening to him and the reports that have come out when people try to get to him through his bubble, and the people who surround him are terrible right now, Kirby, Blinken, McGurk. When people try to get him to empathize and humanize with Palestinians, they say it's like an impasse. Like, his trademark empathy isn't there. And he keeps going back, but the 1,200 Israelis who were killed. And he goes back to this story in the early 70s when apparently he had this meeting with Golda Meir that he wants to tell everyone that story like 40 years later. You know, and that's the problem, is that he's still stuck in the early 70s, not realizing the current moment and where the base is going, where the majority is going, right? The latest polls show that a majority of Americans, Republicans, independents, and Democrats want a ceasefire. As the protests in Israel grow, and I think they will, because now it's clear, as what we've been saying for months, that Netanyahu does not care about the hostages. The spokesperson for the families of the hostages said last week that there was a ceasefire offered by Hamas on October 9th. All the hostages for a ceasefire. Netanyahu rejected it, didn't inform the families. And so now, we're recording this on a Wednesday. Over the weekend, Netanyahu went ahead before there was, you know, while they were dealing with the ceasefire, and said, no matter if there's a ceasefire, we're going to invade Rafah. He wanted to put the sand in the gears. And guess what's happening? And Rafah, for those of you who, you know, it's so much that's happening, just to remind you, that was the quasi-red line that Biden gave. He said, nope, not Rafah. And so the timing of this, right, is that you're acknowledging and remembering a Holocaust genocide, saying never again, as Israel, according to now a majority of Biden voters, folks, about 57%, is committing a genocide against Palestinians with U.S. supplies, weapons, and money. And as that's happening, no mention in the spike of rampant Islamophobia. And Chip Roy, the Republican, says, quote, I have some strong concerns about Sharia law and whether that'll be forced on the American people, with a straight face, Daniel, because you mentioned abortion. What? You don't have to worry about Sharia. You have to worry about white Christian nationalism. All right.
Right.
We ain't the ones in Alabama and Arizona trying to take this country back. What year was it in Arizona? 1863?
1864. Yeah, 1864.
Yeah. And by the way, in Jewish law and Sharia law, abortion is allowed up to a point, right? So it ain't us. So this is happening. Plus, the protesters are being crushed by a militarized police and called terrorists. Literally, people are calling them terrorists. Bad faith journalism saying, well, what are the protesters saying? I'm like, you just listen to them. They're very, they're very clear and eloquent. They're talking about a ceasefire and they want divestment. And as this is happening, when I tweet this out, Daniel, and you've seen my Twitter, I get Democrats and Biden supporters just trying to beat me up. I'm a hater. I'm helping Trump. Why do I care? Why am I blaming Biden? And I'm trying to say, and what we have been saying for months, is you are missing the tea leaves. This movement is not going to go away. Even after school ends, Danielle, and as Netanyahu is committed to these war crimes, I think this will just keep moving on, building until the DNC. And I'm worried. In addition to like the war crimes, I'm worried about what this will do for Democrats.
I mean, I think that what the DNC is going to see, which they haven't seen, is going to be massive protests, right? Like, I think that they are going to see massive protests. There was an Axios poll that came out that said, oh, this isn't the issue that young people care about. It's only a fraction of a fraction. And this is when I say to folks that, like, polls are largely bullshit. Right? Like, you ask, a certain amount of people, a certain amount of questions in a way, and I don't need a poll to tell me what my eyes are telling me, right? What every campus is telling me. And, you know, what I think Mitt Romney in conversation with Blinken made very clear in a clip that went around on social media.
That was wild.
Was what was the admission of why they want to ban TikTok, which is that young people are getting too much information and it's coming directly to them and they can't control it.
Specifically, right? About Israel-Palestine.
And specifically about Israel and Palestine. And so I think that, you know, Biden is in trouble. And I have said this, we have said this, and we get called out for saying it. And I take no joy in saying this. I am terrified as I say it, because I will be incredibly honest that I know that I'm going to vote for Joe Biden because I know that I have to. It isn't like swallowing a hard pill. It is like swallowing razor blades wrapped with knives, dripping in bleach. That's how I feel right now, knowing that the end result is going to be that decision. Because like you have said, Waj, this is Sophie's choice.
Yeah, and I just want to expand on that for a moment, because whenever I try to warn on Twitter, which is like once a week, you've seen the replies from Biden supporters and Democrats who are so angry. And, you know, they shame me, they mock me, they think I'm an idiot, and I don't know, as a Muslim man, as a son of immigrants, as a brown person, the threats of Trump. Trust me, I know. You can't shame and mock people into voting for Biden if they sincerely believe, their vote is complicity in an ongoing genocide. The word genocide is not thrown around lightly, folks. And I want to remind people, a majority of Biden voters think that Israel is committing a genocide with direct support and aid from the Biden administration, who has gone out of his way to say that he's a Zionist, repeat IDF talking points, you know, reduce the number of Palestinian deaths, punt on any sort of accountability when it comes to Israel, acknowledging their violation of international law and humanitarian crimes, giving them aid and millions of dollars after they killed the staff of the World Central Kitchen, which included an American. And now another news item, which I have to admit, which I have to remind folks, is about 12 Republicans threatened the ICC prosecutor and said, you better not prosecute Israel. If you do, we'll make your life a living hell. And then says on Holocaust Remembrance Day that Hamas has ancient hatred against Israel, which is such a terrible, ugly stereotype that this is a Muslim-Jewish hatred, right? That somehow we're like all Muslims and Arabs innately hate Jews. It's nonsense, Danielle, right? This goes back, if you want, to 1948 or maybe 1917, right? The 20th century. It has to do with Israel, which many people say is a settler colonial state, where the realization of the Jewish dream of having the homeland has come at the expense and shattering of the Palestinian people. And you've seen that Islamophobia, right? They all hate Jews. What do they say about the protesters? All anti-Semites, all Hamas. So I'm sitting there thinking, why are you just shitting on your own base, your own voters? Look at the polls, Danielle. If 50%+ of Biden voters thinks it's a genocide, do you think it's a smart idea leading up to a pivotal election where our democracy is on the line to just mock them?
No, I don't. And I think, and again, you know, I pray that people listen inside of that administration to what is really happening and the fact that this isn't going away, that they can decide to ban TikTok, shut down all social media. But what's done is done. What people have seen, they can't unsee. And what they feel, they can't unfeel. And so I think that we are at a reckoning moment. We'll continue to cover this and tell the truth and have hard conversations, because that's the point of democracy-ish. But we're at a pivotal moment. And the next couple of months are going to lay out for us whether or not we hold on to a very imperfect democracy, or whether or not this administration hands it over to Donald Trump, because the decision at the end of the day, I think, is going to be theirs. And coming up next on Democracy-ish, our conversation with author and social scientist Mark Rank, discussing his new book, which is all about luck, which we think Biden is running out of. From the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel of a young black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about David's 18 months working for the senator's presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets a myriad of people who raise a set of questions. Questions of history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that forced David to look at his own life anew and come to terms with his identity as a young black man and father in America. Inspired by the author's experiences working on Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, Cunningham uses a political campaign as his narrative backbone. Great Expectations will be one of the talked about novels of the year, Colm McCann. Great Expectations is available wherever books are sold.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves. Real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, we are very excited to welcome to Democracy-ish social welfare professor and the author of The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us, Mark Robert Rank. Mark, it is great to see you on Democracy-ish. I'm very fortunate because I had the opportunity to speak with you on my other pod. So I'm excited to bring you to this audience and with my fabulous co-host, Wajahat Ali.
Thank you, Mark. Danielle told us a lot about you. She spoke very highly of you behind your back on one of her 83 podcasts. And it is my honor, since she has already introduced you on Woke AF, I will do my movie phone introduction, and I'll try my best to promote you and your excellent new book, which just dropped last month. We encourage everyone to read it. It is called The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. Mark Robert Rank is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis. He is widely recognized as one of the foremost experts on issues of poverty, inequality, and social justice. To date, he has written 10 books on a range of subjects, including an exploration of the American dream, a new understanding of poverty and inequality, and the role of luck and chance in shaping the course of our lives. In addition, he has published articles in numerous academic journals across a variety of fields. And now he joins us on Democracy-ish. Welcome, Mark. I hope I did that justice.
You did justice there. Thanks. It's great to be with both of you today.
Awesome. Well, Waj, I will let you kick things off if you so choose.
No, I do. I appreciate it because I think your book is so important because it shatters these myths. The myths of the American dream, the concept of meritocracy, the concept of pull yourself up from the bootstraps. You know, Danielle and I are the children of immigrants, and our parents oftentimes were told the story. If you make it and you come here and you work hard and you do everything right, then you will have a chance at the American dream. And so many of my parents' generation, and I would even say my generation, right? The ones who I would say it's due to luck. Right. I'll give an example of my family. I tell the story all the time. My father was lucky enough to be an 18-year-old in Karachi, Pakistan in the year 1966, right when America passed the 1965 Immigration Nationality Act. If my father was born 5 years earlier or 10 years earlier, I don't think I'd be here. It was just a random occurrence that my grandfather invested some money and my father went to school and he was of that certain age. And thanks to the Civil Rights Act, Immigration Nationality Act passed, and my father and all these other Asian immigrants came here and he was able to pursue an education. And then he was able to get married and I was able to be born in the Bay Area. All these random factors, Mark, I was telling my story, are just luck. And that's what separates me from all these brilliant kids. I've gone to Karachi so many times, and I sit there and I look at these kids. I'm like, what separates me from this kid? The only thing that separates me is I got lucky. They're smarter than me. They work harder than me. They're more resilient than me. They have more grit than me. I just got lucky. And I wonder how many other Americans born and raised here just benefited from luck and not only pull themselves up from the bootstrap, but pull up like 18 family members from their bootstraps, and it's not enough. Unpack that. That's my life that I vomited out for you, Mark.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what you're talking about is just, you know, is characteristic of the book that, you know, the way that our lives unfold, the twists and turns, so much of that is influenced by luck, chance, and randomness. And, you know, your example is a great example. If the immigration law had just been, you know, a few months one way or the other, and all these things could have played out much, much differently. And actually, I've In the book, I talk about, you mentioned the idea of meritocracy and this whole idea. And basically what research has found is that, well, yes, I mean, certainly skills and talent and grit and all those things are important, but really they're only necessary conditions, not necessarily sufficient conditions for getting ahead. And I'll give you a great example of that. And you kind of alluded to this a little bit. In the entertainment industry, you see, and I'm quite familiar with that. If you talk to actors or musicians, they will almost always tell you, you know what, there's so many talented people out there. And the reason why I'm where I'm at is because I got a lucky break early on. And, you know, you hear that story over and over again. Now, as I say in the book, we particularly in Americans downplay the idea of luck and chance because we want to believe we did it on our own. You know, rugged individualism, we pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps. And again, there's certainly those things are important, but we lose track of the real importance that luck and chance plays throughout our lives.
You know, I think that what to me is the most interesting thing is how our public policy is built off of fantasy in a lot of ways, right? In this idea again, the rugged individual, if those that are, let me say this, not just the rugged individualism and pulling yourself up from your bootstraps, but the notion that if you are supremely wealthy right now, then you are also a genius. If you are poor and live in poverty, right, then there is something wrong with your character. We don't ever talk about the fact that an Elon Musk, for instance, was born into an extraordinarily wealthy family, right? Had access to all types of education, of wealth, of the right circles. And that was part of what bolstered him and put him in the right place at the right time in order to do the work that he does. We always seem to rid ourselves of what happened of the middle, right? And just equate, you know, the genius to the wealth or the poverty to the, you know, unfortunate characteristic flaws. And I wonder, Mark, again, talk to us about how our public policy, how our social safety nets have been created in a way that we don't think about the randomness. We don't think about the luck that is involved in wealth creation in this country. And then our policies showcase that.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm writing something right now about this. And your point of this idea that, you know, we think that we live in a meritocracy and those who do fabulously well, like Elon Musk or whatever, must be the most talented people. Actually, there's been several analyses that show that those who hit it really big certainly have a baseline of talent and skills, but they almost always have had a bunch of lucky breaks. And one of the things you were just alluding to is the lucky break of the lottery of birth. Who are our parents? What are their social class? What is our race? What is our gender? All of these circumstances have a really profound effect on our life, and they're random. I mean, just the fact that we're even born, just think about it. Your parents had to get to find each other. They had to find, I mean, the fact that we're here is completely by chance, and we should be grateful for that. But yeah, and so in terms of our social policies, you know, the way that our policies in the United States are largely based, particularly the social safety net, is that we make it very difficult for people to get these programs. And the idea is that, you know, you really have to deserve it to get some kind of assistance. And the way that I talk about these things is that if you accept the fact that there's lots of randomness and chance and bad luck in the world, then the way we should think about our social policies is the way we think about social insurance. We buy social insurance because we don't expect to have an accident tomorrow or the next day, but we realize down the road we might experience some bad luck. And that's the way we should be framing our social safety net in our social policies, is to say, you know what, things can happen to people over a long period of time, and why don't we put some things in place to protect them? And I'll give you one example of why this is so important. So a lot of my research in the past has focused on issues of thinking about the life course risk of poverty. And Danielle, I think we have talked about this earlier a few years ago with an earlier book. So what I've shown is that actually over a 35 or 40 year period, the chances of Americans experiencing poverty, it's about 60% of Americans will wind up a year below the poverty level, and 3/4 will experience either poverty or near poverty. Now, people say, well, how can that be? The reason, again, is if you think about over a long period of time, bad things can happen. Bad luck can occur. So things like getting sick or losing a job or a family splitting up or a pandemic happening. And when those things happen, our social policies are very weak in terms of protecting people from falling into poverty. So this has some, I think, real, and I talk about this at the end of the book, some real implications in terms of thinking about our social policy.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
You know, I think narrative is so important, and I think the reason why your book can be so disruptive, and I think people would reject it in a knee-jerk way, is because the whole concept of the rugged individual, manifest destiny, pull yourself up from the bootstraps, is part and parcel of white supremacy in the American fiction, right? That removes Black people, slaves, women, child labor, Indigenous Americans, and says, oh, you know, and also promotes the mild minority stereotype that, oh, these are the good immigrants. They worked hard. What's your problem, poor Black mom? What's your problem, oh, refugee? Just work hard. There's no racism. You know, Waj's parents made it. And that whole function of luck and how it flips on both sides, you know, I've shared this on the podcast before, is I'm the beneficiary of luck of the 1965 Immigration Nationality Act. My father, you know, was a student that allowed us to achieve upper middle class success for a while. And then we lost everything. And then it was 10 years of poverty, just due to bad luck and terrible things that happened. And so I saw both sides, which gave me an awareness, understanding that when I was poor, and I was actually literally poor, you know, when I filled out my taxes, they put me in low income poverty status. I'm like, this is wild. I worked harder than everybody else. I was more judicious. I wasn't reckless. Still wasn't enough. I just need a little bit of help. And I say this with these two news items I just dropped today. I don't know if you saw it, that Trump's tax cuts will actually cost us $3.8 trillion, according to Bloomberg. The tax cuts for the rich, which shockingly did not trickle down or stimulate the economy. And number two, some good news. Housing, it's soaring. Housing costs have soared. So if you're lucky to be a homeowner before the interest rates swelled up, guess what? Hold on to it, because now you have wealth. But oops, there also showed that renters, which are now a majority, are SOL. So right. Rich people got richer, poor people got poor. The whole concept, I think, then of randomness and luck completely then destroys history and what allowed many of us to get those homes in the first place. If you had to interject your narrative into these two current news items that just dropped, how would you correct the record?
Oh my God. So, you know, I mean, you're pointing out some, you know, really just spot on points here. I mean, one of the things that I talked about, I think, Danielle, we talked about this earlier, was the whole concept of cumulative inequality or cumulative advantage and disadvantage. So what happens is, you know, I make this analogy of, you know, we think about in the United States that the playing field is level, just like Waj, what you were saying, that, you know, everybody can sort of do it on their own. And what I say is, like, let's imagine, you know, we think about a game of Monopoly where we have three players, they're all starting out at the same point. And now who's going to win or lose? Well, it's going to be the skills of the players and chance and luck.
The white guy with the cane and top hat.
Yeah. But now imagine player one starts with $5,000, player two with $1,500, and player three with $250. Now we're still going to have the same rules. Skill and chance are still good, but the way that chance is going to play out is going to be much different. So the player with $5,000 is going to be able to win almost all the games, even if they're less skilled and if they have less luck. And that's sort of what you're getting at in terms of race, that, you know, wealth over time has been accumulated in the white population, not with folks of color. That has a tremendous effect on how well you do in terms of your life outcomes. And so, you know, this whole thing, as you point out, really casts a different light on this. And again, folks don't want to, this goes counter to the American ideology of rugged individualism and all, and I did it on my own. And, you know, when you start talking about lucky breaks or unlucky breaks, people often see that as taking away from what they've done and what they've accomplished. And certainly, as I say in the book, it's not all one or the other. You know, there's a combination going on here, but we so often discount the role of luck and chance.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what's important to understand, and I think that as people get older and they understand and kind of reflect back on their careers, for instance, and the different opportunities that came in, well, I happened to be in the right room or green room or at the right book signing or in a certain space. And all of those things, had they not happened in, you know, in succession, would have been, you know, you missing an opportunity. Mark, we had talked about the movie Sliding Doors, right?
Yeah.
And talk about, like, you know, you're missing the train or you're getting on the train and the outcome of your life is very different.
Yeah.
So the last question that I have for you is really, I guess, not necessarily a big one, but I think an important one, which is, what is it that we get most wrong about randomness and luck and chance, and why it's something that is important enough to be studied and investigated and researched in the way that you have?
Yeah, well, I think, Danielle, I mean, the thing that we really get wrong about it is that we severely underestimate the effect that it has in both in our lives and the world around us. So one of the things I talk about in the book also is how history has been shaped by randomness, the natural world, there's all kinds of things. But here's one way that I like to think about this, and this might be getting at your question a little bit as well. What I like, you know, I'm trained as a sociologist. So, you know, sociologists are interested in structural kinds of things. And here's a way I like to think about how chance and luck play out. There's certain strong currents that push our lives in certain directions. So, for example, social class and race and gender, and those all have a profound influence on our lives. There's no question about that. But within those currents that push our lives forward are the ripples of randomness. And those really affect the specifics of our lives. So the exact job that we're in, who our significant other is, it has a really strong effect. So this is a way of thinking about how both structure and chance and luck interact with each other.
Oh, I love that. And I just love the visualization that you offered us with the currents and the ripples. Mark, we can't thank you enough for making the time for Democracy-ish. Folks, the book is The Random Factor, How Chance and Luck Profoundly Shape Our Lives and the World Around Us. And it is out now, and you should absolutely pick it up.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Danielle and Waj. It was great talking with the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Democracy-ish. We will be back next week if, in fact, we have a country left. Inshallah.